Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
The battle for Sinjar, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. Kurdish fighters push back against ISIS in northern Iraq, and this Syrian activist has a message for jihadist wannabes.
You want to come to protect the civilians? See what ISIS do to the civilians. You want to come because you believe in Islam? See what ISIS do to Islam, to Muslims.
And later, Ben Carson's foreign policy advisor has a plan. Step one, an all-Christian U.S. military.
And then use the military to, in his words, indoctrinate the American public, and then onwards across the world.
Plus, the men who want to fix world soccer.
You got a prince, a sheikh, and three guys named Infantino, Champagne, and Sexuale.
That's all ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, this is The World. We start today with an update on a war that's been going on mostly in the background, the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS militants in Iraq. There are American airstrikes against ISIS there almost every day, but today's blitz was on a different scale. Dozens of targets were hit around the northern Iraqi town of Sinjar. You might recall that's where ISIS massacred thousands of Yazidis' men last year before enslaving the women and children. The goal of the airstrikes today was to support a big push by Kurdish Peshmerga soldiers to retake Sinjar. BuzzFeed's Mike Giglio has been watching the battle since before dawn from the slopes of Mount Sinjar overlooking the town.
I actually slept at the top of Mount Sinjar, which overlooks Sinjar town. And that is a safe place to watch the fighting from. It's outside of mortar range and firing range. So what happened was, you know, the airstrikes woke us up, and we and some Peshmerga soldiers watched the explosions from the distance. And then, you know, early in the morning, convoys of Peshmerga soldiers just started rolling down the mountain in Sinjar. And eventually we went down there as well and onto the outskirts of the town. And we watched as they, you know, started the offensive. And it was, you know, it was a big, large-scale offensive. In between the U.S. strikes just hitting constantly and the amount of Peshmerga soldiers on hand, I mean, they said 7,500 would participate in this operation. I don't know if that's true, but I can tell you that there were just lots and lots of people on hand. And they still haven't made their major push into Sinjar yet, which we'll really see those numbers play a big role, I think.
Are there Americans there on the ground?
I could have sworn I saw some Americans watching over ISIS from a ridgeline embedded with the Peshmerga, but I didn't get a chance to ask, and I could be wrong. You know, there are definitely people, whether it is Kurdish special forces or U.S. special forces, helping to call in the airstrikes. And, you know, like the presence just constantly felt when you hear the pounding, actually feel it in your chest of the airstrikes. You know, Sinjar is a really symbolic place at this point in the fighting against ISIS based on what happened there and, you know, the whole world watching in horror as they took this genocide against the Yazidi religious minority.
Yes, it's the home of the Yazidi minority who were horribly persecuted by ISIS last year. There are some Yazidi fighters among the groups attacking, trying to retake Sinjar, aren't they?
Yeah, I was surprised by how many Yazidi fighters I met just talking to Peshmerga around the front today. And, you know, they, I think, have mixed emotions as this offensive is going forward. You know, they said, you know, it brings back memories of the time when ISIS did come in and, you know, commit those horrible massacres of their friends and relatives and take over the city. But on the other hand, I think that they feel empowered by the opportunity to be part of this force that's trying to take it back. You know, I was standing on a hill with one Yazidi fighter, and he was trying to point out where his home was, and he hasn't been there in over a year. And, you know, he told me, you know, he's really anxious to get back.
The preparations for this attack were not very secret. Tell us how you got to be there to watch the whole thing take place.
Well, they were supposed to be secret, and I think to an extent they were, but the flip side of that is that they also, the Peshmerga also wanted the media to be there to document it. So some of us were able to find out that it was commencing, and, you know, there was some waiting going on, but ultimately, you know, they did let some of us come ahead of time and be on hand for when it began.
I understand you got some social media guidance from the Kurds. What did they tell you?
That was part of it. And, I think they're pretty savvy. You know, they, as part of rolling out this media offensive, they rolled out a hashtag and they encouraged journalists to use it. You know, they were really adamant that we should, you know, put that in our tweets.
What's the hashtag?
Free Sinjar.
All right. Mike Giglio from BuzzFeed on the slopes of Mount Sinjar. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much for having me.
Taking on ISIS is highly dangerous, and not just inside Iraq or Syria. 2 weeks ago, two young Syrian activists were found dead in their apartments in Turkey. They'd been beheaded. One of the victims was a member of an underground network called Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. Raqqa is the ISIS capital in Syria. The activist group has members there who smuggle photos, videos, and information out to Turkey. Members on the Turkish side then distribute the news from Raqqa to the outside world. Reporter Marine Olivesi met with one of the activists in southern Turkey.
I'm sorry we can't meet at the office. That's the first thing Tim Ramadan says after greeting me. I wasn't recording then because we're still in the hotel lobby and Tim didn't want to be interviewed in public. Tim isn't his real name either. We thought Turkey would be safer than Raqqa, he explains later on in my hotel room. Now that feeling is gone. Since the early days of the network, a year and a half ago, Tim and his friends have been in ISIS crosshairs, literally. Their website, called Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, documents life in the self-declared caliphate, from the gruesome executions and child soldiers to the mundane power cuts and bread shortages. It's a far cry from the sleek, self-aggrandizing version ISIS offers in its Hollywood-style videos. ISIS hates us more than any bomb dropped from the sky, Tim says, because our position comes from the ground. It comes from within. No surprise, then, ISIS has been going after Tim's group with a vengeance.
It's been really difficult for us to work inside Syria on that time because there are spies. They dress like civilians and they go to internet cafes, to the streets, and if they say anything wrong, they will tell their security office, and the security office will take them and maybe execute them, maybe take information from them.
Do you work for Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently? Tim says that's the first question anyone arrested by ISIS gets asked. Every day for 8 months, he dodged that risk. Tim worked undercover as a field coordinator. He produced brochures and graffiti and trained fellow activists to keep their data and themselves safe. He never spent more than a week at the same place, used nicknames, and kept his activities secret from close friends and relatives. Last winter, when ISIS raided his family's home, he fled and joined the half-dozen activists running the network from Gaziantep in southern Turkey. But they were never completely at peace here either.
They send threats on our email, on our personal accounts, on Twitter and Facebook. They also publish photos of our members here in Turkey on the streets and they take photos for our homes here on Gaziantep, and they publish it on Facebook and Twitter, and they said that's the homes for the member of Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, and we can reach you, and we will get you.
ISIS put a $10,000 bounty on their heads. The reward was announced at a Friday prayer, Tim says. Then, a few weeks ago, it spiked to $50,000. Still, he and his friends wondered if ISIS would really act on the threat on Turkish soil. The beheadings of a 20-year-old member named Ibrahim and a friend in a nearby city gave them the brutal answer. ISIS claimed responsibility in a video, making the killings the first known assassinations carried out by the terror group in Turkey. It left the activists in shock and drove them into hiding, or something very much like it. Tim is now back to shuttling between apartments, as he did in Syria. Now more than ever, though, he says the people of Raqqa deserve a voice.
When the Russian airstrike starts, we lose a lot of civilians, and it's really hard for us. ISIS start to say, look to our enemy, they don't kill us, they kill you. It was good for ISIS when the Russian airstrike starts.
Tim says the airstrikes by the coalition and by Russia also created confusion among some wannabe jihadists outside Syria. Every now and again, they mistake Tim's group for a pro-ISIS outlet and contact them on social media.
Fortunately, they are like stupid guys. They will think that they are with ISIS.
Really?
So they ask us that if I want to come to be with ISIS, what I have to do. We don't told him that we work against ISIS. We speak with him, why you want to come? You want to come to protect the civilians? See what ISIS do to the civilians. You want to come because you believe in Islam? See what ISIS do to Islam, to Muslims.
It's hard to know how often this works, but Tim says it's all about telling their side of the story, any chance they can. Later this month, they'll do it at an award ceremony in New York. Tim's group is receiving a prize from the Committee to Protect Journalists. None of the members in Turkey or Syria, for that matter, can go. They don't have passports, but a few members in exile will. ISIS spreads their message to Europe and America, Tim says. It's important to show, so can we. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi in Gaziantep, Turkey.
The scandal-plagued governing body of soccer made a big announcement today. FIFA cleared five candidates in the race to lead the organization. A sixth wasn't considered because he's been suspended while FIFA investigates corruption allegations against him, and a seventh didn't pass FIFA's own ethics tests for candidates. The World Soccer Guy, William Troop, is here to tell us what's going on. And William, what is going on? Who's left in the race?
Well, Carol, you got a prince, a sheikh, and three guys named Infantino, Champagne, and Sexuale. I mean, it's hard not to laugh at this slate. But let me remind people what we're talking about. This is the race to succeed Sepp Blatter, who for many decades ran the organization that runs world soccer and runs the World Cup. And he, by the way, just had a bit of a nervous breakdown. He's under investigation for corruption himself. So it's not a happy time at FIFA at all.
Now, we just kind of chuckled over the names of these five candidates, but who are they?
The main thing about them is that they're all insiders to some extent. So we got Prince Ali of Jordan, and he's a former vice president of FIFA. He's ran for president before, so it's not like he brings a breath of fresh air into the organization. There is Sheikh Salman Al Khalifa from Bahrain, and he has serious human rights accusations against him. Human rights groups have said that he participated in the crackdown against pro-democracy protesters back in 2011. He's accused of having basically helped in the detention and torture of some of those people, including soccer players. So there are calls for him to be barred from this election. FIFA's ethics committee actually allowed him, saying they didn't have enough evidence to suggest that he did these things. And then there's the other guys. There's Gianni Infantino. He's a lawyer, a Swiss lawyer who's been in the administration of soccer in Europe for a long time. There is Jerome Champagne, who's a former French diplomat who has also been in FIFA and has ties to Sepp Blatter. Again, not a breath of fresh air. And then there is Tokyo Sexuale, who is a millionaire from South Africa, who appears to be like an outsider to this organization. He hasn't had a role in FIFA, but he was a part of the organizing committee for the 2010 World Cup, which was held in South Africa. And that organizing committee has been linked with a corrupt payment. So none of these guys are completely clean, and it's hard to see how they would clean up the organization.
And Sexuale, interestingly, he was an anti-apartheid activist. He served time in Robben Island with Mandela.
Yeah, so he plays up that part of his resume to say, you know, I'm from the outside of this organization, I can clean it up. But like I said, it's hard to tell who of these guys would actually do that.
William, you've mentioned FIFA's ethics committee, and all these candidates have undergone integrity checks by FIFA's ethics committee. But is that kind of like the Patriots being put in charge of proper ball inflation?
I would say so. I mean, at this point, I'm not sure that the organization as a whole has any credibility when it comes to vetting its own people for ethics and for corruption. The process that is now in place to vet these candidates is fairly new, and the people who are still left at FIFA trying to police this stuff are trying to do the right thing, but it is an organization that is operating right now under a huge weight of suspicion that everything it does is corrupt.
The World Soccer Guy, William Troop. Thanks so much, William.
Thank you, Carol.
Where in the world is Algeria's president? That's just ahead on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Russian, retirement planning, and rock climbing. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. What do you do when the president of your country goes missing? That's what Algerians are trying to figure out. President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has been out of the public eye for some time now. He's nowhere to be seen. Lucky for us, we know where BuzzFeed's Borzou Daragahi is. We reached him at the airport between assignments. He's been following the Bouteflika saga.
He hasn't been seen in public in recent months. When he has been seen in public, it's usually in very short, curt news broadcasts where he's sitting in a wheelchair, maybe perhaps with a blanket covering his knees. Perhaps he's sitting at a table. There's never any audio. You can't hear his voice. Mostly he speaks through his prime minister, Abdelmalek Selal, who insisted this week, actually, amid some protests and some criticism about the president's absence, insisted that Bouteflika is still in charge and still firmly in control. But he's nowhere to be seen.
Well, I imagine there's rumors flying about what has happened or what's going on with Bouteflika. What are some of the ones you've been hearing?
I think one of the reports that was out there was that he has been again flown to France for emergency medical treatment. Bouteflika is 78 years old. He's been the president of Algeria for 16 years. In recent years, he's become very sick. In fact, in 2013, he spent weeks at a hospital in France recovering from a stroke, and he was rushed for emergency care for a procedure, rather, last year. The thing is that Algeria is a very important country. It has a lot of energy reserves. By landmass, it is the largest country in Africa. By population, it is the second or third largest country in the Arab world, and it's also quite a significant military power and a crucial partner in some respects to the West in the war against the Islamic militant groups in Africa. And for Algeria to be on this course is somewhat dangerous for both Algerians and the West. The fear is that there is a really fierce power struggle going on inside the corridors of power and authority inside Algeria. And if Bouteflika were to pass, there would be a fierce battle for who would succeed him, with various factions jostling for power. And this country, this giant really, that has been a rather force of stability, at least since its civil war ended in the late 90s, would follow into the steps of other countries in the region that are descending into chaos, including neighbor Libya and to some extent, much lesser extent, Tunisia.
Now, Bouteflika is serving his fourth term as president. How popular is he?
Well, I mean, that's a kind of interesting question. It's hard to gauge because in recent years, there's been a lot of alleged rigging of elections. No one's quite sure what the various political forces are. Last time I was in Algeria was for an election. And, the numbers just didn't add up because, you know, we saw very few people at the polls. It seemed like there was just a lot of apathy. And yet somehow turnout was extremely high. So a lot of people suspect that there is rigging. But I think that as sort of ailing, as corrupt as his entourage is, as unable to implement reforms as he has been over the last 16 years, there aren't a lot of alternatives. And so I suspect that he's probably more popular than many of the other people who are around him and competing for power.
If Bouteflika is nowhere to be seen, who's running the country right now?
Some people say it's Saeed Bouteflika, the president's brother, and his sort of circle of allegedly corrupt business people, members of the business community. Others have long said that the security forces run Algeria, various generals, various people from shadowy security ministries and so on. There has been a fearsome purge of many of these top leaders, including the country's top spymaster, who was retired from his job after a long time. He was the world's longest serving spymaster. He was retired in September amid what many see as a fierce struggle for power. It's really opaque who's actually running the country.
BuzzFeed's Borzou Daragahi telling us about Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who hasn't been seen in public for quite some time. Thanks, Borzou.
Always a pleasure.
I have Nina Porzuki in the studio with me. She co-hosts The World in Words, our podcast about languages and the people who speak them. Nina, what's in the podcast this week?
Well, Carol, we are talking about singing and accents and all the complications that go along with it. And I wanted to share one little tiny tidbit from it. One story that I heard from this linguist, her name is Jane Setter. She's a linguist and she's also a singer. She sings in a cover band in Reading in the UK, and she's a linguist at the University of Reading. And she was telling me of a recent controversy that was happening over there over the singer Alicia Dixon. Now, Alicia Dixon, this gets a little complicated, was part of a group in the UK called Mystique. She went solo. She was a pretty big deal. And recently, Alicia Dixon, the singer, was asked to sing the British National Anthem. And Jane Setter will explain the rest.
She's from this rhythm and blues soul type background. And she was invited to sing the National Anthem at the British Grand Prix. And she sang it. She sang it in the kind of soul R&B style because she's a soul R&B singer.
Sounds okay, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, except when she sang it, she created this huge stir all over the UK.
Send her victorious, happy and glorious, long to reign over us. God save our queen.
Doesn't sound very British, does she?
No, she's really got the God. Very American.
Exactly. So American. And people were outraged by her American accent. Except, Jane Setter, that linguist who I introduced earlier, says that she doesn't actually have an American accent. There's really only one word in what you just heard that's American sounding.
It was one vowel, and it was God. And if you sing the word God on a sustained note, the main difference between the British and the American pronunciation of the vowel in God is that in British English you have rounded lips, but in American English you don't have rounded lips in standard type accents.
So singing in accents, it gets really complicated. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. In the podcast, we're exploring other examples of singers getting it wrong. And we're going to even quiz our resident music head here in the newsroom, Marco Werman. He makes an appearance.
That should be interesting. He knows everything. But, you know, that British singer, she sounded more American than most Americans. I mean, she sounded, her God was God. Well, it even leaped out at me, and I'm American.
It's that one vowel, but it's also the style of singing she sings in, R&B. There's a whole lot of things that are more complicated than just the pure accent. But a lot of people focus on the pure accent.
Sounds interesting. And you can listen to the podcast on iTunes or anywhere else you download podcasts. Thanks, Nina.
Thanks so much, Carol. And I'm going to leave you with a little Rolling Stones today. They're Brits, but they certainly sound American to me.
Sweden goes from welcoming migrants to reimposing border controls. That story is still ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. State-run TV in Russia seems to have aired plans for a top-secret military torpedo.
It has this kind of highly devastating Dr. Evil, don't give the kids the remote kind of feel to it. You know, the question is whether it really is top secret or whether this is a bluff.
So, bluff or blooper? That story's coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, a collection of podcasts from PRI with global voices and perspectives. From Studio 360 to America Abroad, explore and subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The dream of a united Europe envisions unfettered travel across open borders. But for months, that dream has been crashing into the harsh reality of the migrant crisis. We have two stories now about European Union countries that are putting up new border barriers, literally in the case of Hungary, as we'll hear in a moment. First, to Sweden, where the government has reimposed border controls for the first time in decades. A top official said the goal is not to limit the number of asylum seekers, but to better control the flow. So far this year, Sweden has granted asylum to more people per capita than any other EU country. But it hasn't been easy welcoming all those new arrivals, according to Fredrik Segerfeldt. He's the founder of Migro, a Swedish pro-migration think tank.
Of course, in the short term, there are administrative hurdles and there are problems finding places where these people could sleep. But there's also been a change. Like, the tide is turning and changing in Sweden somehow. We've always been the most open country in Europe. Public opinion support for immigration has been markedly higher in Sweden than the other European countries. But somehow, this attitude seems to be changing really, really fast. Just the last few weeks, there's been a huge, strange turn. And the politicians have felt a lot of pressure. But I still think that we're more open than the rest of Europe.
What do you think is contributing to that change of heart?
Well, I mean, if you build up an atmosphere with TV stories and radio stories and newspaper headlines about the system breaking down and the absorption capacity is limited and so on, and then you have all these more Islamophobic, we're importing ISIS, etc. So it's like there's both these parts, I think, of the story.
But isn't the Swedish government simply saying it's trying to keep track of the flow rather than actually limit numbers? It doesn't sound terribly draconian.
Yeah. No, but that's political jargon. They feel the pressure that they have to limit. They're walking a fine line politically, trying to say to people, don't come to Sweden, at the same time as they're very afraid of being seen as immigrant, unfriendly, Islamophobic, etc.
How are the migrants being resettled? I mean, I've read in Germany that, you know, towns are being asked to accommodate certain numbers. Is that what's happening in Sweden?
Well, there are two different issues, I think. How do we accommodate these people during the asylum process? That's not the major problem, though. The major problem is, how are we going to get these people into the labor market in the long run? Because Sweden has a real equality problem, which is the least income differences in the Western world. There are no easy, low-wage jobs. Those kind of jobs don't exist.
But there must be low-wage jobs in Sweden. How are certain things, from street sweeping to fast food to... can there not be low-wage jobs?
We have much fewer staff per certain services than in the Anglo-Saxon world. The difference to me, I've lived in America, I've been to the UK many times, there's always like three times as many clerks at the counter in America than in Sweden, for example. So a much more higher degree of optimization, for example, and technology level is very high and so on. So a lot of these service jobs that exist in the US don't exist in Sweden.
If Sweden has been accommodating migrants for many decades, what kind of jobs have those migrants ended up having?
Well, we have this serious problem. We have the highest gap in employment rates between foreign-born and Sweden-born people of all OECD countries, of all rich countries. So we have a serious integration problem. It's very difficult for one of the most equal countries in the world, one of the richest countries in the world, one of the most advanced countries in the world, to absorb hundreds of thousands of people from the third world. And hence, we need larger income gaps and jobs with lower wages and simpler jobs. And that is the main challenge politically, of course.
The thousands and thousands of migrants that have been arriving in recent months, what are most of them doing if there aren't the low-wage jobs for them to have? Is there a government system of providing income?
Yes, of course. They get housing, they get food, and they get daily allowances. You know, on average, it takes 8 years for a refugee to get a job in Sweden. 8 years.
Wow. Fredrik Segerfeldt is the founder of Migro, a Swedish pro-migration think tank. Thanks, Fredrik.
My pleasure.
The government of Hungary makes no bones about it. It wants to keep migrants out and has built plenty of fences to achieve that. It's also arrested hundreds of migrants for crossing the border anyway. In fact, there are now more migrants awaiting extradition in Hungarian detention centers than there are people waiting to hear about asylum applications in refugee camps. My BBC colleague Nick Thorpe reports on how Hungary's justice system is dealing with those in detention.
In the corridor of an improvised court building in Szeged in southern Hungary, a burly policeman clicks the handcuffs back onto the wrists of a young Afghan refugee. "You'll go quietly, right?" he asked gruffly through an interpreter. The man has just been sentenced to expulsion from Hungary. Then he's led away down a busy street to a period of indefinite detention. He cannot be expelled because Serbia, the last country he crossed before entering Hungary, is refusing to take most deportees back. The next day, in another Szeged courtroom, nearly 700 people have been sentenced to expulsion from Hungary since a new law came into force on the 15th of September, making illegal border crossing a criminal offence. Today it's the turn of 38-year-old Samer Kaysun from Homs in Syria. The prosecutor reads out the charges against him.
On the night of the 12th to 13th of October, you entered Hungarian territory, not at an official crossing point, but in a manner declared a criminal offence by Article 352A of the Criminal Code, valid from September 15, 2015.
Ignorance of Hungary's new law, she concluded, was no excuse. The court emptied for the judge to consider the verdict. On a bench in the corridor, I quickly asked Samer and his 17-year-old nephew if they felt they were being treated fairly.
No, everything bad.
I find Samer Kaysun guilty of illegally crossing the border defences and sentence him to a 2-year ban from Hungarian territory.
And Samer and his nephew are led away, clutching their few possessions in sealed paper bags. I asked Erna Simon, spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency in Hungary, what he thinks of the Hungarian procedure for handling refugees.
We understand that Serbia is now not taking back people, so this is why these prison terms last so long. Now people do not know how long they have to stay there. This is an absolutely disproportionate sanction, disproportionate punishment for crossing the border.
An argument I put to Zoltán Kovács, the spokesman of the Hungarian government. Is he not concerned that people seeking safety in his country are being imprisoned?
No, we are not concerned. These people are coming from safe countries. The rulings, the letter of the Geneva Convention wouldn't apply because they are not coming from a country that is being torn apart by war, their life is not in danger, and they travel, again, illegally, 2,000-3,000 kilometres actually until they reach the border of Hungary. And I think the border fence, the security perimeter at the Hungarian border is clear-cut indication that if you try to cross that, that's illegal.
The Hungarian parliament declared Serbia, Macedonia and Greece safe for refugees last summer, even though they're not recognised as such by the UN Refugee Agency. So the government view is fence built, problem solved, while those imprisoned can spend up to a year in jail awaiting expulsion.
That was my BBC colleague Nick Thorpe reporting from Hungary. It'll be warm and sunny for the next few days in Egypt, pretty much as expected for the North African country this time of year. But a week ago, the weather in Egypt was much different. Heavy rains and widespread flooding there resulted in more than 20 deaths. It was the latest in a string of extreme weather events that may well be linked to our warming climate. The agriculture minister in Cairo has warned that Egypt is one of the countries most vulnerable to climate change, particularly rising sea levels in the Nile Delta. And a group of environmental activists is trying to get the word out to Egyptians about just how much climate change affects them. Sarah Rifat is the coordinator with the international awareness group 350.org. She says Egypt has experienced more extreme weather events than ever before.
You know, the past few weeks, there were flash floods that hit a lot of cities on the north coast of Egypt, like Alexandria. The flash floods washed away entire homes, you know, with the furniture, with everything. There were very shocking images that people were, you know, sharing. And also this year we had a very severe heat wave and many people were admitted to hospitals due to heat exhaustion.
So you're getting both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, it's normal for the temperature to go up in the summer, but just the temperatures were very, very high, which was very unusual. And it happened also across different parts of Egypt that were not used to that kind of weather.
How much do people in Egypt know about climate change and its effects on their day-to-day lives?
There are a lot more people who know about climate change now, right now. You know, people were increasingly starting to be aware of that the weather is changing, that they know that something is not right. But there's, I think, a lack of mass awareness, you know. And so this is what we are trying to do.
So you're with a very well-known climate change organization to fight climate change, 350.org. How do you engage Egyptians on this issue? I mean, what specific things do you do to talk about climate change?
The first thing that I did was I created this theater piece talking about the impacts of climate change on water. And then this is how it kind of slowly started growing. We did a very kind of fun, did a bicycle ride.
How do you get beyond those already on board? I mean, how do you move beyond kind of events and move beyond those already interested or the, you know, educated elite to the people directly affected, like farmers and people who are really living it?
What we're trying to do now is actually we're trying to do storytelling projects, you know, basically allowing people to tell their own stories, you know, people impacted. But more people need to know how climate change is affecting them. You know, so far, there's a lot of English language stories out there, but Arabic language stories are very much lacking. We started really as a small group of people, 70 people, and now there are all these different groups, and there are people who were political activists, let's say, and now they're saying, you know what, I want to work on this, I want to work on climate change. So it's a slow process, you know, to really bring people into a movement. But I would say right now, it really is a turning point.
Do you have the ear of the Egyptian government?
There are many organizations here who are engaging with the Egyptian government. I mean, the Egyptian government just today released these commitments, voluntary commitments made by governments to reduce their emissions. So a lot of governments are working on the solutions and what needs to happen.
Sarah Rifat, an activist working to raise awareness about climate change in Egypt. Thanks, Sarah, for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
We head further south in Africa for a quick musical note now, courtesy of rapper Block Jones from Sierra Leone and his new song, Bye Bye Ebola.
Bye Bye Ebola. We just want to say something to the people then. Love X. Follow me then.
Yay.
Ha. Nobody want to see you rising. And when you do, they don't even like it. Ebola come, let them give you a license. Don't take many souls, go away. Oh, Lord have mercy. Don't even know what to say. Thank God that it's over. No time for the haters. Watch me do.
As we reported last week, Sierra Leone has officially been declared Ebola-free after passing the 42-day mark since any new cases of the disease were diagnosed there. Last weekend, thousands danced in the streets to celebrate, and there's more joyful dancing in the video for Bye Bye Ebola. You can see staff members at Ebola treatment centers in Sierra Leone strutting their stuff in empty wards, and policemen dancing the Azuntu, a West African dance, at border checkpoints. Yet there's fear that Ebola could make a comeback. After all, Sierra Leone's neighbor to the north, Guinea, is still battling new infections. But for a nation where Ebola infected almost 9,000 people and killed over 3,500, to have zero new cases is reason enough to celebrate. Block Jones raps, "Thank God it's gone, a new day has come." Here's hoping there are many more Ebola-free days ahead for Sierra Leone.
So go, 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 twist your finger, shake and wave and say hello, no, no, make a freeze and you can be that move. For the first time we ever feel this way. Oh no, it's so hard to bear. Why, oh, follow me then. Big up to every Salomon. Nice to see we all work as one. And now right beat to those who are gone. Your memory leave on forever. See ya never. Oh no. So me say, huh. And now we got all the survivors then. Then I be hero. Make me treat them right, show them love. Send no division, I say. Now that's
the Bye Bye Ebola by rapper Block Jones. And coming up, did Russian TV really show top secret Kremlin plans for a nuclear powered torpedo? Find out ahead on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. Ben Carson has an easygoing manner and real street cred as a political outsider. That's helped him become one of the frontrunners in the race to be the GOP nominee. But we don't know a whole lot about Ben Carson's foreign policy platform. Journalist James Bamford has some insight, though. He's written a piece about Carson's top foreign policy advisor at foreignpolicy.com. Jim, tell us who Ben Carson's been relying on for national security advice.
His main advice comes from Robert F. Dees, who's a former Army major general. And he's been named as the chief foreign policy national security advisor for the campaign.
And what's his background?
His background in the military was in the infantry. His resume doesn't show he ever served in combat, but he held a number of staff positions in the military. After he left the military for the last 10 years or so, he's been focusing primarily on evangelizing the military, turning, for example, all enlisted personnel into missionaries for Christ, basically. That's one of the pillars of his organization.
Within the military?
Yeah. He's now at Liberty University, and they say they have 21,000 military personnel, active duty, either at the university or students online. And that's the idea. The idea is he instills a evangelical sense of Christianity. And the goal of the organization, or the goal he's had for at least the last 10 years, is to first evangelize the military into Christianity, and then use the military to, in his words, indoctrinate the American public, and then onwards across the world. He says that they have people in 20 different countries, and that the military is the best way to turn people into Christianity.
How does Ben Carson talk about that aspect of this foreign policy advisor?
Well, he hasn't really talked much about his foreign policy advisor. Carson, however, has talked a fair amount about Muslims, and his view, as expressed at least a month or so ago, is that he doesn't feel that any Muslim is should be considered qualified to serve as president of the United States.
But he has since walked that statement back a bit.
I think that's probably still his view. He may have walked it back a bit, but I think that pretty much stands out as his view.
You've written that Carson's advisor, this guy Robert Dees, has a history of anti-Muslim bigotry. What did you find?
One point about a year ago, he gave an interview, and what he said was that we don't have really a problem with just a few terrorists coming over here. The problem is with the entire Muslim religion, and they should all be considered suspect until we basically find out whether their end goal is violence.
Now, we've observed Ben Carson on the campaign trail for a while now. What strikes you about the things he said about foreign policy?
Well, what strikes me is he hasn't said much about foreign policy. So that was the reason I began looking into his background. He hasn't really been questioned very much with regard to foreign policy. However, just two nights ago when he appeared at a television debate, he did say, he did talk sort of very confusingly about ISIS and Syria, and he did say he gets his advice from a general or several generals.
Journalist James Bamford, his latest book is about the NSA. It's called The Shadow Factory. Thanks, Jim.
Many thanks.
Every time there's a presidential candidate's debate on TV, you can count on someone dissing Russian President Vladimir Putin. Pretty much all the candidates, Democrats and Republicans, want to talk tough on Russia. So they might be pleased to hear our final story today. Seems the Kremlin may have accidentally broadcast its secret plans for a long-range nuclear torpedo. Apparently, they appeared on screen during a news report on state-run Russian TV. We had to ask our man in Moscow about this. Charles Maines, how did this military leak happen?
Well, there was a meeting that Putin held with top defense officials just the other day in Sochi, and it was broadcast on national television. And as he's talking about various things, including the fact that U.S. allies and NATO were essentially implementing this global missile defense system while ignoring Russia's concerns over it, the camera then slips to this kind of over-the-shoulder shot of one of the generals holding this kind of coloring book diagram of what was called a Status 6 nuclear sub. It's this sort of devastating torpedo system that apparently in subsequent publications from the Russian state media was claimed to be bigger, faster, avoids all tracking devices and defensives, super highly radioactive, super devastating, and never tested. But this was enough just to get the sense that this weapon was in the process. And the only problem was that it turns out it was very top secret. And that's the kind of oops moment that we see here.
Why would the Kremlin announce that there was this mistake? Doesn't it call more attention to it than might be otherwise?
Well, that's right. There's sort of two versions of this. And one is that, of course, this was a huge mistake. As the Kremlin has said, this is Mr. Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, admitted to reporters that this secret data had gotten into the shot and therefore it was been subsequently deleted. But, you know, of course, that bird's sort of flown the coop. And he says, you know, in the future, we'll undoubtedly take these preventative measures so this doesn't happen again. Today, they announced, for example, that, you know, shots of Putin during these sort of highly secret NSA or defense-style meetings, cameramen would be limited in what they could shoot. So, you know, there is that version out there, and certainly backing this idea of very sort of highly secret information and you know, highly sophisticated weaponry coming out of Russia. We've seen this campaign in Syria. You know, there's a sense that the Russians are trying to develop new cruise missiles and trying to develop new weapons. And certainly Putin's put a big priority on upgrading the Russian military. So there's some sense that this could be true.
Has Putin himself come out and said that was a mistake?
He has not. And I think it's worth then sort of dipping back to the other version of this, which is that this is kind of more of a lesson in Kremlin information flow and spin. If you look at just kind of the way that Russian state television works, it's a little bit strange if you think about it. I mean, here they are talking about Russia's nuclear strategies. They're obsessed about this, you know, very worried about this U.S. missile defense system, which the U.S. says is essentially designed to basically deter Iran and other so-called rogue states. And Russia has never liked this idea. You know, they argue that this is really designed to neutralize their own strategic nuclear potential, and that's something that Putin says in this session. It just seems a little strange that suddenly, you know, something like this could come out. So it might be sort of more of a parody kind of experiment here cast through national television.
So are you saying that this whole thing could have been made up as propaganda?
I am. I think that if you look at the way sort of information flow works in Russia, I mean, you know, spontaneity happens in Russia, of course, in life and to a certain degree in politics, but it's not very spontaneous usually in the way it's portrayed on television. So I think that, you know, the Kremlin usually likes to ooze sort of confidence, you know, this sort of supreme sense of mastery of the details and the idea somehow that on national state television, getting through all the censors and everybody else, that something like this would happen, I find it highly improbable. That's not to say it can't be the case, but I think, you know, you can either look at this and think this is maybe just an experiment to see how other people react to it, or you can, it can scare you.
Yeah.
You know, the question is whether it really is top secret or whether this is a bluff.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
And I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge in memory of Debbie Sitt, Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, and the Billy and Dodie Crockett Advised Fund of the Dallas Foundation, by the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Annenberg Foundation, Advancing a Better Tomorrow Through Visionary Leadership Today, annenbergfoundation.org, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.